It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Man, I'm so glad you're here. Welcome, welcome to Money for Lunch. Good to have you here. You know, it's, what do you call it? We got 30 days left of this quarter, a little bit over 30 days, and we only have like 120 days left until Christmas time. Woo! That's kind of scary. You know, at least for me, it's just amazing how quickly time has gone by. Anyway, I'm reaching out to Jason Drone because here he is. Here he is. I was about to text him, but he showed up. So that's good. We're all here. you know what? I always get excited when Jason comes on the show because of who he is. And so I've gotten to know Jason and I have been working together for, I guess, a couple of years now. And the deal with Jason, and I'm going to probably make him squirm because he's what you might consider introvert, super nice guy. But let me tell you a little bit about his story, and this is what's so exciting. He was a Pepsi truck driver in a former life, and he's only been involved in online marketing in 8 years. And he works with people like me and like you who want to elevate their game, right? Who want to get more leads coming in. So he started, like we all do, he started with a desire to change his life. He saw that marketing on the internet was a way for him to do something different. And so Jason Drone started marketing online 8 years ago. And since then, he's been working with thousands of entrepreneurs through his courses and done-for-you services. He is best known, and I can attest to this, he's best known for his quickest path to cash strategies, where he cuts years of testing and development out of his clients' lives and develop and deliver sales funnels that are both automated and profitable. He's always good to have on the show. And what you hear or what you see on the show, I guess what you hear on the show is kind of the way he is. He's just a real laid back, easygoing guy. Jason Drone, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Hey, how are you?
Good, man. How are you doing?
Oh, not too bad. Just keeping busy.
Yeah. And so just to let you know, Jason is in the East Coast, and every now and then I will text him like at, I don't know, 10, 11, midnight my time, and yeah. I'm thinking he's asleep, and he'll answer me back. It's like,
yeah,
you know, you're up 24/7.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you do what you love, I mean, you don't work a day in your life. And I can't say that, yeah. I just, you know, every minute of every day I love. But, you know, there's enough of them that, you know, I just stay busy, you know.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? And I think that this is part of staying young and being happy and fulfilled because, you know, every time I talk to you, you're working on a new project or you're starting to lay out the blueprint of a new project. You know, it's a new piece of software that you and I have been talking about. It's something else that you've come up with. It's another course. And I think that just keeps the juices flowing and exciting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And everything, you know, everything that we do, it all integrates really well together. You know, and that's, at the end of the day, it's about, you know, there's a certain element of what we do, which is focus and focusing on, you know, a core skill set. But adding additional features or, you know, additional things into the mix it becomes fun because then you start to see all the possibilities of what it is you build, or you it gives you additional offers to grow, you know, a business. So
yeah,
it's really fascinating stuff.
Well, and before we get into it, I want to just point this out. So a lot of people will take, you know, whatever, 30 days or a year or whatever to put together a course. And
mm-hmm.
and then they don't launch another course. And I think that one of the things I've learned from you kind of, by watching you is that you are, as I mentioned earlier, you're always cutting out the next thing. You're always working on something else that your clients want. And that's
mm-hmm.
that's not only good business, but it's, as we mentioned, it's good for your mind and your spirit. And it keeps your clients engaged, because the last thing you want is your clients to go, well, yeah, you know what, I bought that course from so-and-so 4 or 5 years ago, but he hasn't put anything else out. So I'm no longer, you know, I no longer go to him. He's no longer relevant because he's not updating
right.
his material.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the biggest things that, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and it's really easy to get sucked into the launch trap where you're always kind of launching
yeah.
something new. But really where growth and revenue and exposure and all that stuff comes from is really just sticking with the same thing for a long period of time, you know? So now when we launch a piece of software, you know, I give it a full year worth of marketing and development and, you know, ideas and creation and updates and, you know, before we move on to the next, you know, a lot of people, especially, you know, internet marketers, people in digital space, they're launching something new every 2 months. And, you know, for me, like the burnout that happens because of that, we did that, you know, and you're always working on something new and trying to find a new type of customer for a new sort
right.
of offer. And, you know, it just, you end up getting burnt out just doing the webinars and, you know, trying to find affiliate partners and all kinds of other stuff. So now it's really, who is our customer avatar? You know, who is it that we're selling to? And then what, you know, A, do they want now, and what B, will they want in the future?
right. But you know what, and I think it's interesting too, because I've been, just like you have experienced, I've been on that other side, right, where that company's putting out a new product, like it seems like every week, and first
mm-hmm.
of all, you don't have time, as a customer, you don't have time to breathe. You know, I want to know that they're going to service the last product I bought from them and not forget about me.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's
yeah,
just like
you're absolutely right. Yeah.
But so let's talk about this, all right? Because everybody probably wants to know this. How do you know what your customers or prospects really want?
And so it's a great question. You know, before, it's funny working with, you know, I've worked with hundreds of clients over the years. We worked on, you know, a bunch of our own businesses and business models. And, you know, it's funny because you can sit around in a room or on a call or on a group chat or whatever and try to figure out what your customers want. Try to
right.
hypothesize what they would buy, you know. But at the end of the day, it's really just a lot easier just to ask them. So the first time, awesome internet marketing experience I ever had, and I don't know that I've ever told you this, Bert, but I had a friend who had a membership program, and I emailed her and said, hey, what do you think your members would like? You know, I can write an ebook and you know, I'm happy to provide the content for free, you know, and put up a landing page and all that other stuff. This was seven, eight years ago. And so I ended up, she was like, you know, I would really like my people to know how to find clients. And I was like, okay. So I wrote this, you know, took a weekend, wrote this 20-page ebook, ended up putting it up online, you know, a landing page, and emailed her with a link and said, hopefully you like this, you know, and whatever. And she linked to it in her membership. And I got, you know, after years and years of trying to build an email list, and, you know, with paid traffic and free traffic and sidebar opt-ins and all kinds of other crazy stuff, within 2 days, I got about 250 email leads. And just within those 2 days, you know, so, and I got to thinking about it. And the first thing I did was, as soon as, you know, on day three, I sent them all an email and said, hey, hopefully you liked the ebook or hopefully you read the ebook. Can you please fill out this very simple survey? It's just three questions. It's going to take you about 45 seconds. And I'm happy to get on the phone with you afterwards and do some free consulting or whatever. Again, I didn't know what I was doing, but this was just kind of a shot in the dark.
Right.
So I asked three questions. The first is, what did you like about the report? What did you like about the ebook? The second question was, what didn't you like about the ebook? Now, mind you, I spent an entire weekend writing this thing, so I was pretty close to it, you know. That was a stretch for me, asking what didn't you like about the material that I shared. And the third question was, what additional questions do you have? Like, what is it? What else can I provide for you that would help you in the process? So out of the 250 people who signed up, we ended up getting about 80 responses to this little survey. And what that then, I took all the things they liked and I used them as testimonials. I took all the things that they didn't like and I improved them. And then I took all the additional questions that they had and I recorded videos for all of them and ended up selling it as a video course. It was my first digital product ever. We ended up selling it for a year or two and did really, really well with it. So it was all based on this idea of asking people what they wanted more of. Really that changed the game for me because it's not my ideas. It's not, you know, I've been doing it long enough that, you know, now I kind of know what people want. But when you're first getting started with trying to engage with your audience and build stuff for them and figure out what to sell, then surveys are your best friend.
I love that. I love that. And what's so cool about that is that you don't have to guess, you don't have to fret, you know exactly what it is they want, and now if you're smart and motivated, you just got to give them what they want.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's just it too. You know, like I work with a lot of clients and they're, you know, they're getting customers in and coaching clients and all kinds of other stuff depending on the business model, and they're like, well, what do I do next? I'm like, why don't we just ask them? You know, they're already paying you for something, you know, whether it's a $7 report or, you know, they're already paying you. Why don't we just ask them what else they want from you and then offer that? It doesn't need to be complicated. And the first couple of times that we pitch it, it can be wrong, you know, but at least we're moving in that direction. And you know, people who – your customers are more forgiving than just flat-out prospects. So, you know, and that's really fueled a lot of growth – for us, especially in software. So about 2 years ago, we switched to just being a software company, creating hosting apps. And Scriptly is our best performing software. And every piece of software that we've created since has been directly, you know, has been a feature request. Or, you know, and maybe it doesn't fit within Scriptly per se, you know, but our members are looking for a solution for X. So we're building a CRM, you know, an email marketing platform and a call scheduling or phone sales platform. And, you know, that was a direct, it was taken right out of member feedback, you know, from Scriptly. They're like, well, you write the emails for us and you write the webinars for us. How about you let us email them too? Well, Scriptly wasn't really built to do the email marketing, but we can create something that ties in and end up working with that. So surveys, you know, at the end of the day, it's member feedback and asking the right questions gives you all the insight in the world that you need.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that. But, okay, so let me ask you this. What if, let's say there's somebody out there who's got a list of different clients, right? I mean, maybe somebody had bought books or maybe somebody else has bought some coaching or somebody else has bought, you know, maybe I'm trying to think, you know, maybe they're in multiple, what do you call it? Multiple niches. That's a better way of doing it. Maybe somebody's, do they get the same, you know, they're going to get the same marketing message or same survey, or would you just segment it out per each individual list?
That's a great question. So what I do, we have a lot of clients who come to us for, I mean, they might have a list of 5,000 people, and the 5,000 people are all, you know, let's say they're all into property investing, but we don't really know real well, you know, what kind of properties they're looking for. This is a from a client, you know, so
right.
some within property investing, there's lots of different, there's multifamily homes, there's condos, there's single family homes, there's, you know, there's all kinds of different, you know, specialties, and investors tend to pick a niche that they like, and, you know, just because of contractors and everything else. So the you know, what we end up doing is we end up emailing the entire list to a survey, and then based on their answers, and so we usually, the survey is usually 3 or 4 questions. The first question is always, it's kind of just, it's a micro commitment. We already know the answer to it.
Right.
We want them to confirm. So the first question is always, you know, in this instance, do you invest in property, or are you a property investor? Do you have property, whatever, you know, and it's yes or no. And from there, so 90% of people, because they're on this list, we already know that they're property investors, they're going to click yes. So question number two is then, it's usually a little, it's a little more specific. So what kind of property do you invest in? Do you invest in single family homes, multifamily homes, commercial real estate, you know, and gives them a couple of choices that they can pick. So they go through, they pick their choice, and then question three is actually the most important one. Question three is, what is your number one challenge with property investing right now? Or what is your number one challenge for getting into single family homes or whatever? You know, is it sourcing the homes? Is it funding the homes? Is it rehabbing and flipping the homes? You know, so we're asking exactly what challenge somebody has. So here's the cool thing that surveys let us do now, as opposed to, you know, when I first sent my first one 8 years ago.
Right.
What surveys let us do now is, based on the answers, we can actually trigger email sequences, emails, follow-ups, you know, phone calls. We can do all kinds of really cool stuff with surveys that we couldn't even dream of before. You know, so if somebody goes through the survey, they're a property investor, they invest in single family homes, and their number one issue is sourcing, you know, sourcing deals, then what should we present to them in email? We should talk about single family homes. We should talk about the internet tools that we use to fund those deals or to find the deals. We should
right.
talk about putting property, you know, securing the note on the property. We should talk about some private funding stuff or some bank lending stuff, whatever. You know, but it needs to be specific to an investor investing in single family homes who has problem finding deals. So that's how you take a really big niche or a really big list or a pretty wide group of prospects or leads, and you segment them down so that you're communicating directly to them and selling your product.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And I hope that everybody is able to wrap their head around this, because it is a very simple thing. You ask them what they want, and then you give them what they ask for. You know, don't overcomplicate it, right? I mean, it's just that simple. And in some cases, it could be a $7 or $10 report that you put together. And in some cases, maybe it's a brand new course to help them source those homes, or, you know, whatever it is that they're most interested in. So I love that. And for you guys, some of the stuff that we talked about in this call with Jason is Scriply, and you can find out more about Scriply at scriply.org. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, scriply.org.
Scriply,
write out your email sequences.
Right. So it's an automation, done for you type service that everybody should jump on, unless you love spending, you know, hundreds of hours putting together your email marketing. Then if you just love that, then of course you don't want to do this. But if you want to save literally hundreds of hours and kind of get some expert copywriting done for you, then Scriply.org is the place to go. I wanted to ask you this question real quick, Jason, because again, you've been doing this for a while. What's a personal habit that contributes to your success?
Getting shit done.
Getting crap done.
Yeah.
But you know what? It sounds, but it, you know, we've talked about this multiple times. You mentioned it in today's show. We get distracted. We shift our focus, and all of a sudden, something that we started doesn't get done. And I know from working with you that you sit there and you drill down, and you'll stay up 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning because you want to get crap done.
Yeah, it really, nothing is ever going to be perfect. And once you realize that nothing is ever perfect, and you're able to create much more freely. And at the end of the day, it's funny working with clients, nothing, as much as we talk on the phone, as much as we strategize and everything else, nothing ever actually gets done until they we put in the work and they see something on the website, or they see a page or whatever, they see, read a piece of sales copy. Nothing ever gets done until we're actually looking at a physical result of work, And at the end of the day, when you're in marketing, my ideas might not be the best. Your ideas might not be the best. Whose ideas are the best? The customers. But in order to ask them, you need to get some sort of information. You need to get an email address. You need to get, a credit card number. So, at the end of the day, it's really just about getting stuff done and working through the process.
Yeah. No, I love it. I love it. I think it's great information. I'm excited about all the different topics, nuggets that we handed out today. Great stuff. Guys, check out Jason Drohn. You can just Google him, Jason Drohn, DROHN.com, or you can check out scriptly.org and get some help. Jason Drohn, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thanks. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Good stuff there from Jason Drohn. Again, former life, he was a Pepsi truck driver, and just like he talked about, he started, inching his way into this internet marketing thing, and now he helps thousands of entrepreneurs globally create sales and automate their marketing. So just a fun guy to hang out with. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase Mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool. You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, who's next?
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Paul Schumacher, is an author, academic, and entrepreneur, as well as a co-author of a recent book, Winning the Long Game, with his co-author, Steve Krupp. Paul Schumacher, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you, Bert. Good to be with you.
You bet, you bet. Let's talk about this. The book is called Winning the Long Game. And so tell us a little bit about the book. Who's the audience for the book?
It's mostly people who want to be leaders or who are leaders, who run companies and also entrepreneurs who start companies, who tend to operate in fairly uncertain environments. So the focus is on how leaders can shape their external environment and more quickly understand it to better adapt to these changes.
Gotcha. All right. So my next question is, and I always ask this of our authors, is why write the book? You and Steve are sitting around talking, and all of a sudden, what was the motivation or the catalyst or the aha moment where you said, we got to write this book?
Yeah. Now, well, your previous guest gave the answer in a sense. You know, we deal with clients. I founded one or two or three companies, and one is a consulting company, and we do strategic planning and leadership development. So we ask organizations, what is your biggest challenge? And at the top, people say we have lots of people who are good operationally, you know, good execution skills. But what's really lacking is strategic capability. The people are not thinking out of the box. They don't see around the corner very well. And they even don't know what it means to be a strategic leader. So, you know, take a typical performance review. They might say to the person in the middle of the organization, great job, you're really good. But hey, you should have seen that competitor coming or this new product being introduced. And you have to become more strategic. And then that person might say, well, what the hell does that mean, more strategic? And then you may get a very broad answer, do what Wayne Gretzky did, skate to where the puck will be, but that doesn't help people really. So we wanted to write a book on what does it practically mean to be more strategic as a leader. And in the book, we identify six key characteristics that we profiled both from studying the best leaders, also looking at why people fail as leaders. And it's even based on a large survey, about 30,000 people were tested. And this has to do with actually the topic that you previously discussed, how to anticipate better. That's a major topic, what Elon Musk, you know, excels at, and what Nelson Mandela did after he became president in South Africa. And he realized that he had to anticipate lots of opposition and things like that. And then challenging yourself and others, that's what Pope Francis is doing for the Catholic Church. It's these kinds of characteristics, interpreting conflicting data, you know, connecting the dots, what Sherlock Holmes, the fictional character, does so well. But CEOs do it also. The DuPont, the CEO of DuPont, saw the, you know, the financial crisis in 2006 or 7 because he connected three totally separate dots. One was a Japanese customer who was having cash flow issues and they asked for more time to pay their bills. Then another one was at the Hotel DuPont in Wilmington here on the East Coast. Was not really full, seasonally very low, which is atypical because most of their customers and suppliers and their own executives stay there. And then Detroit, the automakers, a big company, a big client for DuPont, and they normally share their production plans so you can have just-in-time inventory management, and they couldn't, you know, they didn't provide them. They asked for some delay. So Chuck Holloway is the CEO. He put together these three very disparate signals that came to him over time and suddenly dawned on him, hey, we're hitting a wall. We're going to hit a big wall. And then he started to ask questions in their own company. What's our cash flow like? What are our customers? Are we losing customers? And he prepared the organization, and they survived it much better. So anticipating is one skill, challenge, and interpreting. And there's three more that have to do with deciding and aligning people around you, bridging differences, and learning. So we don't have the time to go into all of this, but the book is essentially about those things and then very specific tools, techniques, skills on how to build that capability, either as an individual, in a team, or in an entire organization.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's interesting when you talk about the CEO who's able to connect those dots together, you know, with what a lot of people thought might be a random, we call it unconnected dots, you know, for him, it really spoke volumes. Let me ask you this. Okay, why don't you tell me a little bit about, you know, who you are as far as, you know, your business background, your academic background. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you. So I'm from the Netherlands, in case people wonder about my accent, and I came to this country, this great country, the United States, at age 20. I first became an academic at the University of Chicago, and then I was a professor at the Wharton School. And then I took a long sabbatical at the Royal Dutch Shell in England, which is a pioneer in what they call scenario planning, you know, a technique to see around the corner. And then I started a company called Decision Strategies International, where we helped companies do this scenario planning, scenario-based strategic planning. And that company grew fairly quickly, recently sold that company to Heidrick & Struggles about a year ago. And then I also got involved in a salt distribution company, Morton Salt, big supplier of ours, one of the largest distributors. I was the chairman of that company. And being European, through family connections, I ran a food additives business in mostly Western Europe, but also partly in Eastern Europe. So I've been trying to be on both sides of the street, the academic side. I'm mostly interested in taking very good research, very good insights, and translate them into the world of business.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And you know what? And so I want to talk about this, too, because you mentioned something that I think eludes a lot of people. You know, and I love the example that you gave about Gretzky, just go where the puck is. That sounds, great in theory, but how do you get there? I mean, and I think that a lot of people either are not trained or maybe don't know how to develop or aren't sure what strategic leadership looks like. Talk about that. Talk about what sets a successful strategic leader apart from, let's say, the rest. Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's really the crux of the issue. It's a great question, Bert. The biggest factor we found between operationally excellent leaders and strategically excellent leaders who create new businesses, who see new business models, who have a view about where an industry will be 5 years from now, the major characteristic we think is curiosity. It's not so much brain power, it's more how they think and how wide their networks are. Do they get good inputs? I'll give you a simple example. I happen to work with a company in Denmark, in Copenhagen, Novozymes, which is a large industrial enzymes company. And the CEO is very good. He's no longer CEO. Former CEO is excellent. And when I would meet him, and I was there as a consultant or a speaker, he would have dinner with me the night before. And I thought he would ask me about, you know, his company or how we could help. What he really wants to know about is what's happening in the United States, what's happening with tea houses in China. Not that I know the answer to all of that. But what was striking was the breadth of his questions, his curiosity. And not only did he do that himself, so he just had really innate interest in many things. So, because then you see more, you talk to more people, but he also created this ability to be inquisitive in his own organizations. So your listeners, if they're running companies or they're in, you know, either as leaders at the top or they're in the middle of the organization, ask yourself, how interested are leaders in general, is our culture, in things that they maybe are not exactly focused on? What we call, how good is your peripheral vision? Are you picking up weaker signals about either customers or new technologies or regulations that may be happening or economic issues, political issues? And we wrote another book, it's an earlier book I did, called Peripheral Vision, Detecting the Weak Signals That May Make or Break Your Company. That's the subtitle. And what's interesting in Bert, we have lots of examples there of companies who got blindsided. We all get blindsided, either in our personal lives, we may not realize what our kids are up to or why the kid has trouble at school. And the busier you are and the more focused you are, the less you have peripheral vision. There is a trade-off between focal or central vision and peripheral vision. And the FBI teaches, you know, when they have to protect a president from assassination, they tell their agents, don't focus, look through the crowd, have a very wide angle view. It's almost equivalent of going into a meeting and instead of just being obsessed with your issues and your points, you care much more about you open, like an anthropologist almost, you're listening what other people have to say. And good negotiators, a lot of research on this, think much more about the other side than their own side. I would say that more myopic or more operationally focused managers think about their budget, you know, whether they're meeting their targets. In the meeting, many things that may be mentioned by clients or suppliers or partners that they don't notice because they're not focused. So the periphery is the area outside where you focus, but where interesting things may be happening, right, that are relevant for you, and how open and perceptive are you about that? And strategic leaders, I think, excel at that, either innately or you can train it, as the FBI trains people, or in the security business, you know, when people are at risk of kidnapping, they actually tell people what to do and how to approach these difficult situations and see things sooner and then act sooner.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know what? And some of the stuff you said there is, the difference, I think, between, as you mentioned, between somebody who's good versus somebody who's outstanding. I think that, you know, back to, for instance, the example that you gave about negotiating, when you look at the way the U.S. negotiates versus, let's say, the way the rest of the world negotiates, this is what I've noticed. China, even Iran, when they come to the negotiating table, they're prepared to stay there for days, where we have this habit of the U.S. of getting there and getting it done. I want to get it done now. And
yeah,
and so when one side is in a hurry, the other side's going to win.
Yeah, you're right. You're at a disadvantage. Well, when I was at Shell in London, we did a lot of work in the Middle East. And the first meetings with in the Middle East, in the Arab cultures, is not to talk really about business at all. It's really to just get to know each other. And in the Far East, I think you cannot have immediately a meeting of the minds. You first need a meeting of the heart. That means courtesies, giving gifts, showing interest in what the other side is doing. And in the U.S., which makes it such an efficient culture, we can talk Turkey immediately. I can, like, we are now talking. We've never met, and we are talking, and we're getting into issues, right? And that's also very efficient. But that's not the norm in all cultures. And if you're not aware of that, then I think you are at a considerable loss, as you say. Because, and the joke is, in China, the negotiation doesn't start till the contract is actually signed. So it's not leading up to the contract. It's all open to reinterpretation. And that's culturally a very different way of operating and doing business.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know what? And this is... Again, we could talk about that, for an entire hour there, or actually probably an entire day, because there's so much to learn there. But I like what you said, so I want to emphasize this, that good strategic leaders, negotiators, planners, CEOs are thinking about the other side sometimes even more than they're thinking about their side. And when you're thinking about, let's say, the customer's point of view – or the other negotiator's point of view, or maybe your employee's point of view, you think differently, and therefore you achieve different results.
Yeah, to give a very simple example, if I have a leaking faucet and I need a plumber and the person comes out and quotes it to be $120 to fix it, okay, if I view it as a zero-sum game, I'm going to just try to get it cheaper somehow. But if I view this as a discovery and I say to the person, I learn more about that plumber, I say, okay, what about if it's very flexible? You can come whenever you have time. You don't have to pre-commit. Or maybe I can recommend you to a neighbor, or maybe we have some other work that needs to be done. But if you view negotiation as not getting more from the other side, not win and lose, but rather both being better off, that means you on the hunt for creative solutions. But you can only find that if the other person trusts you enough to really tell you what they would also like solved, what their other unresolved issues are. And that at a higher level, when you're talking about diplomacy or dealing with Iran and the U.S., that's, of course, that's three-dimensional chess, right? It's not just the issue that's on the table. It's all the other issues, and it's all the future implications of all these things and the options those create.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's a very sophisticated game, I think, at the highest levels.
Absolutely. No, and I like your analogy of three-dimensional chess. So it's not just chess, it's three-dimensional chess. And you're right. When you're looking at these top-level negotiations, if Shell and, let's say, Exxon negotiate a deal, nobody will probably hear about it. Even though they're very big and it's very complicated, most likely we're not going to hear about it. But when the U.S. and China sit down and negotiate, we hear about it on a day-to-day basis. We hear about it before it happens, while it's happening, and after it happens. So you have all these dimensions that have to be planned for. Let me ask you this. Let's start with how can our listeners start to implement some of your ideas and insights in practical ways?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be self-promotional, but obviously we wrote a book about it, so that wouldn't be a bad starting point, we think. But if you want a cheaper solution, we also wrote an article in the Harvard Business Review about a year ago on being strategic. But there's obviously training that can happen. I think modeling yourself after people you admire. Look at people in your own sphere, right, at work or elsewhere, and ask, who is actually a good leader? And it could even be people like Churchill or Sherlock Holmes, fictional characters or actual leaders. But I think you need to have role models. And it could be, Mandela for some people, and it could be other individuals, could be sports figures, etc. And it's not just to admire them, but to ask the question, what are they doing that I would not be doing? You might ask yourself, if you have a tough decision, how would Winston Churchill probably look at this? Now, you can't ask him anymore. He's dead. But anyway, that mindset. And I think you may want to just think about these six elements I mentioned. Are you good at anticipating? Are you good at seeing, you know, proactively figuring out what's happening? Are you truly challenging your own assumptions as you try to solve a problem? Are you solving maybe the wrong problem? Maybe you should ask other people for, you know, their framings of the situation. Are you good in connecting data? And the problem is we're so overloaded with data, you know, big data and analytics. But my sense is that we are data rich, but synthesis poor. There's so much of it that we don't know with how many of the millions or trillions of dots to connect. And that requires asking good questions. I think it was Voltaire who said, you don't judge a man or a woman by their answers. You judge them by their questions. And we do this with our PhD students. We really judge, are they asking good and relevant questions? Because one pivotal question can just change the whole perspective on the issue.
No, I think that's that's great, and I like that. And you know what? And it's not. Yeah, it might be a little self-promoting, but at the same time, look, the book is called "Winning the Long Game," and you wrote it for a reason. You want to help people get educated. I mean, you know, so it's something. If somebody wants to become a better strategic leader or planner, it's a worthwhile picking up. Let me ask you this real quick: what's the best piece of advice you ever received?
Yeah, to spend more time on reframing issues. I think that we go through life and other people set our agendas. Sometimes we held hostage by other people's agendas, not in a physical sense, but in an intellectual sense. And to think for yourself and to have the courage to do that and become the master of your own, of the problems you're willing to spend time on and the ones you don't want to get into, that to me was very good advice. Because it's liberating. It lets you really do what you really want to do. And for too many of us, we still live lives that are not optimal for us. And it has to do with the constraints we impose or the goals we pursue, but they're not the goals that most directly connect to our essence as human beings, what we want to really get out of life.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
It's a liberating message fundamentally. Be yourself.
Control
your own
absolutely.
Life.
I like that so very, very much. Paul Schumacher, thank you so much for stopping by. Again, the book is called Winning the Long Game. You can find it on Amazon or wherever good books are sold. Paul Schumacher, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks, Bert. And we have it in many languages, so not just English. All the best and thanks
wonderful.
Again.
You bet. Good stuff there from Paul Schumacher and Jason Drone. Just a great show, great nuggets of information, and I love the stuff that Paul was talking about, these strategic steps, if you will, to becoming a better leader, a better father, a better, mother, a better person in general. Strategic thinking is, I think, is more powerful than just plain tactical thinking. You need both, but, you know, the difference is being able to see the bigger picture and how the chess pieces are on the board, so to speak. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.